Getting us in here with a responsible day for the 13th of Adar Rishon. 13th of Adar is, and not in the year when it's at Adar Rishon, 13th of Adar, I should say, is Tanit Esther. This is the fast of Esther. So there aren't that many Tshuvot responses written, and those that are written are primarily about Purim issues. So we're going to take a couple of short responses today, three, I think. The first of which has nothing to do with Purim, but it's a response of the Maharam Milublin. Maharam Milublin lives in the late 16th, early 17th century, so it's very exciting to me that we can... Maharam Milublin has a commentary in the back of the Gemaras on Tosas, whatever. He's an important Rav, and we don't often find response... going back that long ago, so I always like to try to take those, even though it's on a topic that I often avoid, because it seems to be A, technical, and B, there are so many of them, I worry that I'll get caught up in those, which is the question of how do you write names in a get. So one of the things to point out, I maybe don't say it often enough, is that, you know, I am trying to select these as, quote, randomly, unquote, as possible, and that's part of how I came up with the idea of finding responsa by date in the calendar, because it's sort of a completely arbitrary, it would seem like, anyway, a completely arbitrary standard. But it's also true that as I'm choosing, I'll choose ones that seem most interesting to me. Now, that's a very bad qualification, because then you're limited by my range of interest. So every so often, I try to make sure to choose, take a tshuvot that would step outside. Here was a good example, because the 13th of Adar of Shin Samach, which is the year 1600. So in 1600, Maharam Milublin, Shut Maharam Milublin, Siman Lamed Tet, responsum number 39, addresses the question of how to write a get, and we'll get to that in a second, but let's pause to remember to thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hochhauser, for putting these shirim online and making them available to you. So, Maharam Milublin is writing to a fellow rabbi, and there was a get given in the area of this other rabbi, and so he had been sort of asked to rule about the get, and she lives near the court of Dubna, the Beit Din of Dubna. The Beit Din of Dubna is the one that is going to deal with her case. Now, her name, often when it comes to gittin, people in those days, their names weren't always the same. It could be that you got to be known by one name, you know, when you were growing up, and you moved to a new place, and you liked a different name, so you chose a different name. That's not a problem halakhically, except that it becomes a problem in terms of writing gittin, writing documents, because when we write documents, we need to identify the parties involved in an absolutely clear way. Otherwise, we have worries about maybe this get really wasn't given to her by this husband, maybe it was given to another woman by another husband, and she grabbed a get and claimed that she was, these are the worries that come up. It's not that they're necessarily practical worries, it's that that's the way the halakha works, is that the document has to be, you know, self-describing. It has to be completely evidentiary on its own. So you talk about the Shema Ktiva, the Makom Ktiva, the place where the get is written. Let's say she and her husband are no longer living in the same places. So there's the name that she was known by in the place of the Ktiva, and then in the place of the giving of the get, right? An easy way to imagine how that might change is, let's say a woman, you know, is married in L.A. or New York or Atlanta or wherever, and that's where the husband is still, and she decides she doesn't want to be married anymore, so they separate, and she decides to move to, you know, Paris or to Israel. And when she moves to the new place, part of building a new life is she takes a new name, theoretically. So that's how you could imagine there would be a difference between the name that she has and the place of the writing of the get. The husband's going to write the get in New York or Atlanta or L.A. She's going to get the get in Paris or London or, you know, or New York or Israel. But in this case, her name was the same in both places. Her name was Mirush. Now, I was struck by this also. I think, I don't know if it's true, and maybe I'm just digressing for my own purposes, but when I was growing up, we had relatives all over the world. It was a different time. You know, I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s. The Holocaust was still not just alive as it is now for us, but it was alive in terms of the people that lived through it. So families had scattered. So we had relatives in Israel who I'd never heard of, and we had relatives in Brazil who I'd basically never heard of. And this is the part that I still remember today that always struck me. They sent me bar mitzvah gifts. Meaning these were cousins of my grandmother's, or right, so they were sort of like aunts and uncles to my father, Alav HaShalom, and my grandmother, Alav HaShalom, I should have said, but these were cousins of theirs, so they knew each other from back in Europe, and they knew that she had had a grandson, basically, who had a bar mitzvah, and they sent me gifts. It was remarkable that I really never met them, ever. I years later met, one or two of them when I went to Israel for the year. I met some of them. Anyway, one of them was a Tanta Mirush. That was they had a Tanta like that. So Mirush was it was often a diminutive for Miriam, but the other woman's name, her name is Mirush, but where she was born, where she grew up, they called her Miral. Okay, so I actually had one aunt who was named Mirush, another aunt who was named Mira, and I can never get them straight because I didn't know them, right? Because I never met them anyway. So here you have a woman whose real name is Mirush, but where she was growing up, years and years before where she was growing up, they called her Miral. And she has relatives who are called Miral also, meaning named after the same person. The man who was setting up the get, so this is where it comes the problem, right? My Rabbi Lublin is writing to a rabbi who's not the rabbi who set up the get. This is a rabbi who's on a rabbinical court, and he's faced with a get. And in the get, the man who wrote the get, and writing a get is a serious issue. So people aren't supposed to write get unless they're really qualified to do so. But especially back then, the definition of qualified wasn't so clear. And many people wrote get, and then they didn't know what they were doing. And they thought they did. They didn't. He had written Miriam Hamukhuna Mirush. He wrote Miriam because he thinks that Mirush is a diminutive, like a nickname for Miriam. So he assumes it must be her name is Miriam. So he writes, and that's the real name, and this is just a nickname. So he writes Miriam, who's called Mirush. Now, if her name really was Miriam, that wouldn't be a terrible way to write the get. But the fact that she was never called Miriam, not at birth, that's called a Shem Arisa. Shem Arisa means the name she was given at birth. Not her birth name wasn't Miriam. And not in the place where they wrote the get, she was never known as Miriam, and not in the place where they gave the get. So it's clear that she's never been called Miriam, and in fact, where they were living, Mirush wasn't a diminutive for Miriam. I'm sorry, I got that wrong, right? It's not that it's Miriam, it's a name, right? And they don't call Mirush Miriam, Miriam Mirush. It's just, so this get doesn't work at all. And it's clear, the Maharam says it's clear in the Rishonim and Akronim, it's not a get. And he says, there's no need to prove it. It's just so obviously not true. Right? There are certain things that are so obviously untrue. The get is invalid. And therefore, what you really should have written in the get was just Mirush. What the person was teaching, because that's all she's known as. She's known as Mirush. She's known as, no, you say to me, but she was known as Miral growing up. But growing up doesn't matter to us, because once she's been married for a while, and now the marriage is coming to an end, there's the place she lives with the husband, or there's the place the get is being written by the husband, there's the place the get is being delivered by the husband. If in those places she's only known by one name, then you don't have to put more names in the get, right? The putting more names in the get is if, so sometimes if there's a birth name, because that seems to have a stronger status as name, even if she's not called by that anymore, that will need to be included. And other than that, there are names that she's known by in the place where the get is written, the get, and the place where the get is given, because that's what we're concerned with. We're concerned that the get in those places serve as a fully valid document to identify her. So he quotes Bala Tshuva and says that's the halacha, that if those places, her, she has only one name, we don't need to put more names in the get. That's especially true in our case, he says, because nobody remembers that she was ever called Miral. It's true, growing up she was called Miral, but nobody knows that anymore. Of all the people I associate with her, so there's no reason to put the name Miral in the get. Not only that, he says Mirush and Miral are very close to each other, and it's not clear that they're different enough that you have to write it in the get. But if you want to make sure to have no doubts, he would agree, you write her another get. That's clear you're going to have to do, because the first get is invalid. And what they'll write is Mirush, then not Hamukhuna. Mukhuna means who's also called, who's also known as, or who's also, right? But here he says, use the word Dimitkere Miral. So Mitkere means, use a different verb. It's like Mukhuna means like it's an actual name. Who's also given the name is Hamukhuna. Dimitkere is who's also called. He says, use the language of who's also called Miral, because since they're not, neither one of them is in Hebrew, we don't say Mukhuna. Mukhuna means who's also got the name of, and that applies only to Hebrew names. Now, it happens to be the husband's already married another woman, because he thinks he's given his wife a get. He's gotten married again. So the Maharam Lulin says, you got to force him to give a get to this woman. If he starts giving you problems, tell him he has to separate from the second wife until he gives a valid get to the first wife, and then that should take care of the whole thing. And that is the Maharami Lublin's solution to this problematic get. So that's our first response for the 13th of Adar for Tanya Nestor. Has nothing to do with Tanya Nestor. It's just a response written on the 13th of Adar of 1600 of Shin Samach. Second Shuvah for today, we're going to see two Shuvah, two responsa of, so we're actually going to see many more than three. We're going to see four or five, I think. Two responsa of Rav Cook's from the 13th of Adar. Sorry, it's not true. We're going to see one responsa of Rav Cook's from the 13th of Adar with notes on it that refer to another responsa being written. But it's a responsa written on the 13th of Adar of Tuf Reish Pei, 5680, which is 1920. It's from Shur Orach Mishpat Siman Orachayim. Siman Kuf Mem Vav, response number 146. So the tshuva, and then there's in the notes, they have like another tshuva. So in the tshuva itself, it's about reading Megillah in Bayit Vegan. So this is 1920. And Bayit Vegan in 1920, and this is a topic that comes up in other postgame as well, it's a very interesting topic, is Bayit Vegan is not connected to Yerushalayim yet. It's a new neighborhood, and it's connected to Yerushalayim by road, meaning people go back and forth. It's thought of as being part of Yerushalayim. I actually recently encountered there's a version of Mishnah Berurah now that has like in it or updated Pesachim, and apparently Hashem Zalman Auerbach regarding not Bayit Vegan, but regarding Ramot, ruled that if a city is municipally considered part of a place, municipally considered part of a certain city, then it counts for that city for the purpose of whether you read on the 14th or the 15th, which is not a Pesach Rav Kook is going to say. It's an interesting idea, right? Because the Gemara only talks about the question of Samuch and Nirav, whether it's close enough or whether it's seen with. So there's the remote was a problem because of there's the definition of that is complicated. Here too with Bayit Vegan, he says, I looked into it, and it seems to me that as long as it's not yet completely connected to Yerushalayim, meaning there's more of a space between that and Yerushalayim than 70 amot and a little bit. So 70 amot and a little bit of the area is the distance for Erevin purposes. When we talk about it for Erev Tchumen purposes, for example, if you want to know where 2,000 amot is, so you can always go, if there are houses right next to each other, that's not yet the end of the city. How do you know the end of the city? So the halacha is, complicated halacha, the halacha is that when there's a break of 70 amot and a little bit, so 70 amot and a little bit is no more than 150 feet, which today, in terms of the distances that we think about, is not that big. So that's a big question to me in halacha about how you deal with that issue. But that's the halacha that halachists are dealing with, the postgame are dealing with. So you're saying Bayit Vegan is certainly broken off from regular Shalayim at more than 70 amot and a little bit. He says, for as long as it's not connected. Now, he doesn't bring up the issue of why not, it doesn't count as close since it's within 2,000 amot or whatever the standard would be, or why it's not nearer, which also seems to be the standard for Allah. He doesn't get into that, so we're not going to get into that. But he says it's got to be like Ayarot HaMisupakot. It's like those cities which aren't sure of when they should read the Megillah. And the examples he gives are Hebron and Tveria. And I'm not sure what they do in Hebron and Tveria today, but his understanding is that cities like that, which aren't sure if they have a wall or are connected to a city that had a wall, going back to the time of Yehoshua ben Nun, he says they're required to read on the 14th, read Megillah on the 14th without a bracha, and read Megillah on the 15th with a bracha, and that's their main part. So I think it's an interesting topic that comes up in a bunch of places to how you define what's connected to a city or not. That's the question of Nismach, of Samach, of Venira, whether it's close enough. So close enough, Rav Kook assumes, means that it has to be within 70 amot and a little bit. They'd have no breaks of, no empty spaces of that, otherwise not considered Samach. Venira would be that it has to see it, and that would be a question of its own. And then in place where you're not sure how to paskin, you read Megillah twice, you read it on the 14th without a bracha, and on the 15th with a bracha. In the notes there, so they bring, and here this is signed by Rav Kook, who was writing in Zaymel and Tuf Resh Mem Dalet. Right, this is they put it here. I'm not sure why when they printed it, but it's an old thing he had written. He'd written to his father-in-law because he signs it as your son-in-law, who's like your son. He wrote to his father-in-law in 1884 in Zaymel. So that's a while back. He's a very young man in 1884. I'm pretty sure he's like 19 years old. And he's talking about a completely different topic. He says, I want to say that the Chai Adam, and the Chai Adam, for us, Chai Adam is like a distant posik, but it's a 19th century posik, it was very, very popular. Rav Kook is talking about somebody who's a generation, two generations before him. He says, the Chai Adam and other poskim, and other halakhic authorities, it said that if somebody knows that if they drink at their Purim suit and they get drunk, that they won't be able to daven Maariv that night, and presumably daven Mincha before your Suda, you won't be able to daven Maariv that night. I mean, let's say you know that the way you get drunk is, you know, if you get drunk at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you get drunk ad lo yada, you don't know the difference between Haman and Mordechai, you're going to be out the entire night until the next morning. So you won't be able to daven Maariv. So the Chai Adam and others had ruled that you can't get drunk then, because you can't, they're assuming that one cannot knowingly put oneself in a situation where they will not be able to fulfill a mitzvah that is upcoming. Rav Kook says, this is the young Rav Kook, but he says, I don't understand, because most poskim hold that when the Gemara says, and this is a hard topic in our times today because there are so many people who abuse alcohol, that it's a very serious issue, and I'm not saying what we should do today, I'm not ruling, I'm just learning and studying Rav Kook's interesting ideas. Rav Kook says that most poskim hold that ad lo yada is a mitzvah, that it's part of a mitzvah, I think he means, that it's part of the obligation of eating your Sudat Purim, of eating the Purim meal, that it includes significant amounts of wine to render one significantly inebriated, such that they don't know the difference between Mordechai and Haman. So And whether or not it's an actual mitzvah of its own, he says, it's at least a standard of simcha for the chazal. It's a standard for what qualifies as the proper joy to have to be celebrating the Purim miracles. That Shui says that at the time one is drinking, one is an osek ba mitzvah. One is drinking to be involved in mitzvah. Now, I want to say I've been in a lot of places where I've seen a lot of people get very, very drunk. I certainly try to drink on Purim, but I don't. I have never gone that far. I've seen people get drunk in ways that I think are deeply problematic, and I'm just not sure I understand Rav Cook's point, and I'm not sure how. And I think this is a point to make. I think there's a lot of cultural elements here. You know, depending on the role wine plays in your society and the way drinking goes and how one handles one's drinking, the experience of being drunk could be very different. I've seen a lot of drunkenness. It doesn't seem to me to have a lot of simcha shel mitzvah to it, to have an element of being a celebration of a mitzvah. But Rav Cook's reasoning at this point in his life was that by drinking, you're an osek b'mitzvah, you're involving yourself in a mitzvah. If you're involved in yourself in a mitzvah, then you're patur from other mitzvah. We have a general principle of osek mitzvah, patur min mitzvah. If somebody's involved in one mitzvah, then they're patur from other mitzvahs. And if they miss things, they're involved in a mitzvah. And that comes up in many halakhic places. And it could even be the kind of thing which will mean that a person might not have a chance to daven one time. So it's not radical or revolutionary of Rav Cook to say that being involved in a mitzvah might lead to being exempt from having to daven. The interesting part of it, or the surprising part of it, is that he's using that in terms of he's understanding the Gemara that says that we have to drink at a Purim Suda to be such a significant obligation, to be so fully an obligation, that qualifies as an Osek B'mitzvah, you're involved in a mitzvah, and you don't have to worry about the later consequences, especially, says Rav Kung, because when that later mitzvah comes along, the person will be an anus. He'll be unable to fulfill the mitzvah. He'll be unable to fulfill the mitzvah because he'll be drunk. But he's an anus. That's out of his control. Now, the response we're going to get to, he's going to deal with it, but the answer should be, well, don't let yourself get out of control. We'll get there in a second, but the point is, when the time for Marv comes, he won't be able to because he's an anus. The circumstances will have stopped him from being able to do it. Now, Rav Cook does point out, and I think this is an interesting point, let's say somebody gets drunk on another date when they're probably not supposed to, right? There's no mitzvah to for certainly, and maybe they're even not supposed to. And let's suppose, therefore, a person, you know, for whatever reason, they go out for a 4, 5, 6 martini lunch, and they get drunk, and they are so drunk that they can't have a mincha that afternoon. Whatever else they do that afternoon, they can't have a mincha. Let's say they pass out, they miss the time of mincha. So what's the halacha there? This is a simple, clear halacha. The halacha is that when they daven Marv, they can say 2 Shemona Esrays. And the second Shemona Esrays will be called what's called Teshlubit. Teshlubit is the idea in halacha that if somebody, through circumstances not of their own doing, either they forgot, either they didn't realize, or they were an anus, they were unable to daven one davening, when the next davening comes along, they can say 2 of that davening, and they can, in that way, Teshlubit, they can make up. It's not quite as good as having daven the first one, but they can make up somewhat for the lack, for their failure to have davened that first time. Rav Cook points out that that's true even if somebody got drunk for no good reason. So they got drunk for no good reason, you allow them to make it up. So here too, he thinks clearly if they're getting drunk for a good reason, a mitzvah reason of the obligations of the Seudah of Purim, then if they happen to miss Marv, they'll miss Marv, they'll say 2 shacharits, the next morning they'll daven twice, and that should be okay. And then he says, you might think, he says, he doesn't think that when there's a mitzvah involved, there's any problem with being machnis atzmo be'ones, right? That's always to be a very significant question, halacha. When are you allowed to put yourself into a situation that circumstances will force you to violate halacha? Or to not do that which you were supposed to do? So Rav Cook is saying, whenever there's a mitzvah, and how broadly he would take this, he doesn't say, but if there's a mitzvah to do something, the fact that it's going to lead to an onus, it will stop you from doing something else, that's not your problem. The example he gives is that the Rambam and many others allow traveling on a boat, even if you know ahead of time that you'll also be on the boat for Shabbat. When you can get on the boat is a whole question of halacha, not our topic here. Let's suppose you can get on the boat on a Tuesday, right? Tuesday pretty much seems okay, even if you know it's a long voyage, and even if you know the boat's going to continue traveling on Shabbat, and even if that means that that something will arise as a need to violate Shabbat, the Rambam, many with him, held that for a Dvar Mitzvah, you're allowed to do it even to get on the boat on a Friday, let alone a Tuesday. So it shows that when there's a Dvar Mitzvah involved, when there's a Mitzvah obligation involved, that does make it plausible and possible many times to take action which will likely or maybe even close to certainly lead to eventually having to violate other commandments. That's a very important principle. I think there are times when it's clearly true that Cliff Cook is right, but he's applying it here to a situation. Whenever you apply principles like that, you always wonder, I think you need to wonder, how broadly can they be applied? And we can't get into that here because it's taking us way too far afield, but I think it's a very important question. I think a place that comes up, for example, is I remember many years ago, a man I knew was thinking of moving neighborhoods. In the neighborhood, he was a doctor, and the neighborhood that he currently lived in, that he lived in at the time, he was able to walk to the hospital where he was affiliated. It was an annoying walk, but he could walk to the hospital where he was affiliated. But that took a long time, and it meant he was often away from the family for more time on Shabbat than otherwise. And besides which, he was living in an apartment. He wanted to buy a house, and the place where he could afford a house was in a place where he would have to drive to the hospital on Shabbat. And he went to a Rav, and the Rav said, yeah, buy the house, because then the force of circumstance will require you to drive to the hospital when it's necessary to save lives on Shabbat, and therefore you're allowed to. So that's what Cook is talking about here in a much less significant, you know, issue at hand, halacha. And I think these are always interesting questions to struggle with, and I think they're case-by-case issues. That's what he says. Here, too, you have a mitzvah obligation to drink. Yeah, maybe that's going to lead you to be then an honest, to be, by force of circumstance, unable to daven ma'ariv. Okay, we have that standard in halacha. What'll happen is, you wake up the next morning, you'll daven too, and that's the way it'll go. I'm sorry, I'm talking about ma'ariv. He's even talking about mincha, because right here he says, you know what, tefillah mincha, if the obligation was to make sure you weren't drunk by the time mincha time came around, then how can the word just say that they should just get drunk at the suda? Well, that's an interesting question on its own. I don't think the only answer is, no, clearly the Mishnah thought you would get drunk and not daven mincha. I think, for example, if you daven mincha before the suda, would be one easy way. And therefore, Rav Cook thinks you could be mekel. And because the being makil about allowing yourself to miss mincha is really being machmir with the fact that it's very important to fulfill the mitzvah of Sudat Purim in its proper, fullest way, to have all of the simcha that Chazal wanted you to have. And that's our second responsible for today. Rav Cook, second responsible within this response of Rav Cook on Beit Vegan as a city, that it was not yet connected to Yerushalayim, and thank God we live in a time when Yerushalayim is growing and much more connected to each other. But if it was not connected, and therefore he was unsure as to whether it could read on the 15th, he therefore thought it should read on the 14th without a bracha, Megillah for Purim, and on the 15th with a bracha. And then our last responsive for today will be Shut Shevet Alevi Rav Vosner from the 7th volume, responsive number 183, from Tainis Esther of Tuf Shim Memchet of 1988. And here the question was, can you use, because 1988 was a Shemitah year, right? 1987-88 was a Shemitah year. Can you use, now many people sell the land of Israel, etc. That's a different topic, but let's assume that you have produce that's Shvi'it produce. It's grown in Eretz Yisrael, but it's Shemitah produce. Can you use Shemitah produce for Mishloach Manot? Can you give Mishloach Manot on Purim? We give gifts of food to each other, to fellow Jews. Can you give gifts of food to fellow Jews on Purim from Shemitah Pradesh? Why is that an issue? The issue is, the Rambam writes in the 6th chapter of Hilchos Shavit of the laws of Shemitah, that the money of Shavit, if you get money for produce of Shavit, if you change that money becomes money of Shavit, Shemitah money, you can't use it to pay back a loan. Right? And you can't use it to do shush binut. Now, shush binut is a system that we don't have anymore today. It used to be, that to make the parties around weddings used to be very expensive. It still is very expensive. Today, just people bear that financial expense on their own. What used to happen instead was that a group of friends would make, I'm not sure they'd make the wedding, but certainly they would make sheva brachos. But, as different from today, it was a friendship matter, but it wasn't a free gift. It was a financial obligation for the people who benefited from that shush binut to reciprocate when it came time for the other person's wedding. So that's shush binut was, now, it was an expression of friendship because it was the circle of friends who were going to be responsible to each other financially to chip in at their wedding times for some of the expenses of the wedding. So it was a friendship thing, but it wasn't, oh, I'll just do it and who knows what'll happen. It's, I'm doing it for you and you're going to have to do it for me. So that shush binut responsibility is an actual financial responsibility and therefore cannot be paid back through Shemitah money, because Shemitah money is not for business purposes. Shemitah money is money that has to be used pretty much for getting food and eating it, because that's what Shemitah is about. It's only about that. That produce is not meant to be an economic good. It's meant to be food that people eat. And the Rambam writes, you also don't repay tagmulin. You don't repay favors that were done or things where there's an expectation that you'll reciprocate in kind. So, Rav Vosner writes, but Shushpinut is even the Tagmulin, because Shushpinut is an absolute halakhic obligation, financial obligation. And if, let's say, you know, the first person made the Sheva Brachos for the friend, and that creates an obligation on the friend to create Sheva Brachos back, and sadly, the friend refuses to do it. It's always sad when things that were a matter of custom and friendship and just everybody did for everybody, you'd have to go by the letter of the law, you'd figure out, well, I paid this amount, you better pay that amount for mine. You could just, everybody would do everybody be happy. That's the better way for the world. But let's suppose one of the Shushpinin, one of the people who benefits from Shushpinim, refuses then to reciprocate, and he may have his own life going on, and he may have reasons that seem valid to him for why he's not. I'm not saying that he's definitely wrong, but it's the kind of thing where you can go to court, and if the court determines that, in fact, this obligation needs to be repaid, you can get that money back from a court. Shushpinut is a real financial obligation. It wasn't their time. But Tagmulin, the Rambam speaks about Tagmulin, that's not a complete financial obligation. It's, I should, because you did this for me, and I should do it for you by rights, not by legal rights, but by moral rights, by ethical rights, by what was done for me, I should pay it back. Even that, the Rambam says you can't use Shemitah money for that purpose. So how do we apply that to Mishloach Manot? It also says there are three kinds of Mishloach Manot that you could be giving. One Mishloach Manot is that Chazal said I have to give a Mishloach Manot, right? That's one, I have to send Mishloach Manot, each day, to one friend, I have to give two Manot. So that's the basic obligation. So there, Rav Ozan thinks, I can't use Shemitah money or Shemitah produce because I am fulfilling an obligation of Chazal with this, and Shemitah produce cannot be used for economic goods or for mitzvah goods. So he thinks that to fulfill that basic obligation, so let's say there's a person who sadly is so poor, he's only going to do one Mishloach Manot. Right, so he could not, that person, that man or woman, could not use Shemitah Pradesh for that. Another way we give Mishloach Manot, says Rav Ozner, is that people give to us, right? You know, I don't know how it works for all of you. Feel free to email me about how it works for all of you. My email is grothst@gmail.com. But in my world, there's making sure you fulfill the mitzvah. Then you make a list of the people that you think you're supposed to give to, your intended friends to give to for whatever. And then sometimes people who you hadn't expected to consider you Mishloach Manot buddies bring you a Mishloach Manot. What do? You return a Mishloach Manot. So that idea of returning Mishloach Manot that were given to you, and that's what you're doing. So then he thinks, if you look in that Rambam, that's the question of Tagmulin. That would be an issue of Tagmulin, of returning a favor done, even if there's no legal financial obligation to do so. He thinks that Rambam would mean that you shouldn't do that with your Shemitah produce either, because it's repaying an obligation. But then there's Tosefa Mishloach Manot. There's just, over and above that, people tend to give a lot of Mishloach Manot to friends. It's a very beautiful custom, and Jews get friendly with each other, and they express that friendship by giving Mishloach Manot. So that level of Mishloach Manot, then he thinks it's clear that you can use that Shemitah produce, because you're not gaining anything financially off of it. You're giving a gift to somebody. You have to tell them that it's Shemitah produce so that they don't misuse it. There are all sorts of halachot about how to use Shemitah produce, but it's not like you're making anything off of it. It's not like you're repaying a loan off of it, and therefore he thinks you're allowed to use it for those purposes. That's the bulk of the tshuva. Then at the very end of the response, he throws in a thing about women and whether they're obligated to give machasita shekel. It's a hard question, halacha, because machasita shekel in the Torah seems to be only about men, but it's clear that they can give it if they want to. But the Yerushalmi and the Mishnah says we're not mimashkininotan. Mimashkininotan means there are times when Beitin says somebody has a financial obligation to some communal organization, the Beitin will confiscate the money, or will take property of the person until they repay the money. So, with women, the halacha about machzir shekel is we're not mimashkin, and that seems to say they're not obligated. Not only that, we only do what's called a zekel machzir shekel. We don't do real machzir shekel today. It's just to remember what used to be done in the time of the Beit Mikdash, and therefore he doesn't think you have to apply it to women. He also points out that in the time of the Beit Mikdash, the Beit Megadim says if you had a poor person, he's obligated even though he's poor. but he's still obligated. But with women, it's not true, and therefore Rosner seems to think that they don't have to give. But we have a chumra, people tend to give just because it's a nice thing to do, and it doesn't cost them that much money. So there's no reason that they shouldn't give, but he doesn't think it's an actual obligation. So for Tani Dester, and I hope your fast is going well if you're listening to this on the day of Tani Dester, we had three tshuvot. We had Marami Lublin from 1600 about issues of writing the name Mirush and Miral, and whether you do or don't in a get. Then we had Rav Kook on two different issues with important Bayit Began, reading on the 14th or 15th, and whether or not one is allowed to get drunk, knowing they will not be able to daven either Mincha or Mariv after that. And then Shush Shevet Alevi about whether you can use Shemitah produce for Mishloach Manot, for giving the gifts of food that we give on Purim. With thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hochhauser, I bid you both a great day, an easy fast, and then a Simchas Purim, a full joy of Purim to come. Have a great day.